Good morning and welcome to Talking About California. Here we continue our series of discussions with Californians who talk about this place, the state California, their home and their work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute. This morning we will be talking with Ann Middleton Wagner. Ann Wagner is the professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, in contemporary art. Can I call you Ann?
Yes, please do.
All right, good. I think it's fair to say that many people outside the halls of UC Berkeley know and value your scholarship, your books, essays, talks. I read countless interventions that have changed radically the face of art history, of feminist scholarship, and of intellectual pursuit altogether. So I think, listeners, we're very lucky to have this chance this morning to talk with Ann. Ann was born in Connecticut. She was educated at Smith College, then at Yale, at Brown, and Harvard. Before coming to Berkeley in 1988, she taught in the Department of Art History at Vassar. Her books include three artists, about three women, Modernism and the Art of Hesse, Krasner, and O'Keeffe, and Motherstone, The Vitality of Modern British Sculpture. Her latest book is A House Divided, American Art Since 1955, which was published last year by University of California Press. And I wonder if we could begin with a little bit about your work and experience in the classroom at the university. I noticed that you said in notes, I'm struck by how many of my recent projects have their origins in the classroom. Not only graduate and undergraduate seminars, but even large lecture courses. Could you tell us a little bit about the teaching of art and art history and its importance to you and its importance in education?
Yes. I mean, of course, saying only a little bit is not easy, but saying a bit more seems possible. First of all, I want people to know that I taught at Berkeley for 22 years, and though that is the time that really has made the most difference to my own scholarship. And I think that as I look back on that period, I think that the sort of catalyst or the relationship between lecturing and writing comes from the fact that I worked so actively on 20th century art while I was at Cal. And 20th century art is a history that is still being written much more actively in many ways than, you know, other centuries of art history, and moreover still very actively influenced by cultural change at the moment, by new interests, by new discoveries. And so one felt that one's classroom teaching was always having to expand and to incorporate new thoughts, new ideas, and also to track in my own research and my own discovery. You know, 20th century art history is a big field, and I found myself encountering what I didn't know and then realizing that if I were going to teach in a way that I thought was responsible, having to master new fields. For example, having to learn enough about art in Japan after World War II to be able to encompass some of how fascinating it was. That was a big departure. Having to learn enough about British sculpture to include it in a course on 20th century sculpture. And that was really kind of the direct seed of the book which you named in your introduction, Mother Stone. And it was really through thinking about how I would teach Barbara Hepworth and Henry Moore that I realized not only was this a subject to be taught, but it was a subject that would be really at the core of, you know, a 250-page book. And that, you know, I had no idea somehow that would happen. I think that for me, teaching has never been a particularly cut and dried operation. And it's always, therefore, been, you know, it changes from year to year. You design a course, and then 2 years go by, and you teach it again, and you yourself have changed, and your own commitments have changed, and the world around you has changed. And so it's never a static enterprise, and it's that expansiveness and that possibility of discovery in the classroom which really characterizes pretty much all the time I spent at Berkeley. You know, and then there is the possibility of when you go back to a topic, sort of enriching it, you know, every time the course is taught. At Berkeley, we were lucky not to have to repeat things in a sort of standard or programmed way. Most professors have a sort of cycle of courses that they can offer. And so you would come back to something after several years had gone by and think about how you would do it differently, do it better, do it deeper, do it more helpfully. And all of this has really mattered to how I understood my writing could develop. I also think if I can continue that,
sure.
Teaching is really has been very important for my understanding of the voice of my writing, and I think that writing should try to explain and to tell a story, and you know, to have a kind of narrative that people can grab hold of and that conveys in some sense a process of inquiry or a process of discovery, a process of investigation, and that you should, you know, I don't want my reader to be quite the same as they were when they started, once they finished any text of mine, how, you know, short or long, you know, I want their... you know, I was thinking back, actually, not so long ago, to my very first writing teacher, and she was an elderly woman at the time. In fact, the story was that she had lost her fiancé in the First World War, and she taught me freshman English in high school. So she must have been quite old, and she never married, and she taught us about the three-part outline, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And I have, you know, never stopped thinking about that as incredibly solid advice.
And maybe on that, would you mind telling us a bit about how you came to this field of study? You know, what it was that inspired you to do this work, and maybe say something about, you mentioned to me the questions that have to be asked about art, or at least in your mind asking. Could you walk us through a bit of that?
I came to art history in a slightly roundabout way, in that I was a kid who grew up thinking that she was going to be an archaeologist, and which maybe sort of packs back into the idea of discovery. And I had read at a tender age, I had read some version for kids of Greek myths. And then in high school, I read God's Graves and Scholars. And I was sure that archaeology was going to be my field until I found out that archaeology as practiced around 1970 was a scientific endeavor. And I was, I think, quite romantic ideas about digging up, you know, lost masterpieces. And that was what was the catalyst to make me switch to art history. I don't know now whether I kind of knew what I was doing, but it seemed like the right choice at the time. And then, and I think just because I have always liked study, I decided that to go on and pursue it at a graduate level. And that process had a lot to do with trying to find something that I felt needed me to do it, and with an emphasis, for good or ill, on the idea of me, as opposed to some other student or professional writer who could do it just as well. And what this involved was turning away. At first, I thought I was going to work on the Italian Renaissance, until I realized that there were many, many people who would work on the Italian Renaissance who would do it much better than I would, and moreover, many people who had worked on the Italian Renaissance. And I couldn't have that sort of feeling of breaking new ground, which seemed to be important. So I ended up working, switching my field entirely and working on 19th century French sculpture, which was a verified field then and a rarefied field now, but ended up being the place where I wanted to be. And it was because it seemed possible to ask there the sorts of questions that continue to motivate my work. And I wanted to know, why does a society want sculptors and how does it produce them? And what were the class backgrounds of the young men, and they were mostly men in 19th century France, who became sculptors, and what kinds of practical knowledge were involved in order to make sculpture? What happened if you failed as a sculptor? Did you move up or down? What did you do instead? And these kinds of questions led me to discover something which still I know is important to the study of sort of the profession of artist, and that is that the barrier between, or the membrane between, the artist and the artisan, or indeed the industrial maker, was a very thin one indeed. And class was determinant in sculpture, in particular, because it was a physical labor, not a mental labor, whereas painting was traditionally thought to be mental labor above all. So that it was working class men who came into sculpture, and then if they made it through the official system, they could become an artist. But if they didn't make it, in other words, if they didn't win the right kinds of prizes, if they didn't win a scholarship to study in Rome, they would fall back into the various levels of production or various forms of production that allowed a city like Paris to be a sculpted city. And just to understand what a sculpted city means, we need to imagine an urban fabric in which all of the sort of the public hardware, the lampposts and the drinking fountains and the facades of buildings and the light posts and so on, all of this had sculpted ornament on it. It was a way of a city marking and producing evidence of its own culture. And it was a very sophisticated world indeed, this world of decoration. But it was not high art. And so it was left to the students who made it to Rome and produced for the official exhibitions and got official commissions of statues to be the great men of the day. And all of that stayed in place, indeed, until Rodin came into his maturity, and he never won a prize. He was an absolute failure. He went downhill into the decorative art kind of production that I'm describing, and then kind of climbed out by his, we might say, bootstraps, but instead it was his sheer invention, and transformed that system of production for forever, where the old way of making good no longer mattered, and different values ruled. So to tell the story of how I got into art history is to tell a story of trying to understand why cultures need art, what they do with it, what they expect of it, to try to understand as physically as possible how art is made, and to think of it as a form of production that societies need. And this has played into my work in different ways. It's not always stressed as much as it is stressed now. And I don't mind saying that once I completed this book on 19th century French sculpture, which I told through a particular artist whose class background was working class and who definitely made it to the top, but pushed at the edges of the limits of production. For example, he cheated on the exams for the scholarship that would send him to Rome, and his work was incredibly controversial. He was just sort of at the edge of rupturing the system that Rodin stepped outside of. But to work on 19th century French sculpture ended up making me think that my work was too far away from a world that mattered to me more vitally in contemporary terms. And that was really the impetus behind turning to a book on artists who were women in 20th century America. It was,
Just before we leave that, though, for our listeners, let's go back to this big question. I know we don't have all the time in the world, but you said, what does a society want in its art? Why is that a question? I mean, where's that coming from?
I think it's a question because we don't really know why human beings make art, and we have to account for the multiple forms that art takes and how it changes. What the societies seem to use art in a very special way. It's a site in which meaning gets lodged, and moreover, where symbolic action happens too. And I'm thinking particularly of objects like sculpture, where the sculpture in the world is a catalyst for how people behave. And there is a direct relationship between what people do and the work of art, the sculpture that is there, and keys in them in a sort of symbiotic way what they might do. For example, think of a sculptural object, a statue, at which people gather annually to commemorate something that happened in that place, a martyrdom, for example, or the feast day of the person who the sculpture represents, or they get together there because they all share the same ideas that the individual represents, or they get together because their own personal losses happened are caught up in what the sculpture commemorates. For example, some place where a sculpture which commemorates where people died, where people were shot, where rebels were executed. And this is one of the things that I find fascinating, that humans use art to code their behavior, to pass it on from generation to generation, and moreover, it works. I find it hard to understand anything about what life means, and art seems to me to be one way of being able to do that, being able to see what life has meant to generations past, or indeed how we keep making meaning around objects that come from some far off moment. This is to me magical. I went today to see a show at the British Museum in London, where I now live, and that show was a show of the art of the Ice Age. I was looking at small figures of women with great breasts and big haunches, no bigger than, you know, a hand, or some oftentimes smaller. And they come from 40,000 years ago, and they had particular functions that we are left to imagine. And we also we see how much thought and care and design the makers were able to bring to these particular objects. And you feel this strong connection to other human beings deep, deep in the past. I think that that's invaluable. I mean, especially now, when feeling connection to reality may be difficult for people to do.
This is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. Our program this morning is talking about California. Today we're talking with Ann Middleton Wagner. She's a professor emeritus at UC Berkeley in contemporary and modern American art, and now living in London. Ann, I think you were about a minute ago to turn to your book, Three Artists, and I think it's a book about three women. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that book. And I'd also asked you, and I know listeners would like to hear a bit about the issue of feminism and how that is tied to your outlook and to your ideas about the study of art.
Yes, well, I remain committed to feminist art. And as I was saying before, one of the things that became, as I continue as an art historian, the question of what your work means to you and how it intersects with its own moment seems to become, at least became for me, more pressing. And I felt that I wanted people to read my work, and I also wanted to be able to answer my own sense that that the invisibility of women, or the relative invisibility of women as cultural producers, to use an awkward phrase, but as makers, and was intolerable. And this was something that didn't come on overnight, obviously. Was part of a larger cultural movement, but I, like many others, had to figure out how to make that mean something to my own work. And ultimately, the way that I solved that problem was artists, all of whom were American, all of whom were married, and all of whom had important careers, not just as artists, but also as abstract artists, or engaged in a kind of abstraction, and whose work could be qualified as modernist. In other words, they had specific ambitions to produce cutting-edge art and to push their art into new realms of practice. And I chose my examples not so that they would all be existing in the same set of years, but so that together they might add up to a history of American art, which I felt I knew well. And lastly, I chose three artists who are fairly well known. I mean, one is Georgia O'Keeffe. She's very well known indeed, and in some sense didn't need me, if needing is important, but whose work I was prepared to examine as not simply for its feminine imagery, but in terms of its modernism, in terms of its avant-gardism, in terms of its cutting-edgeness, and to take up the question of how that worked with her reputation and identity as an artist, how those issues went together. And the second example was Lee Krasner, who was married to the very well-known artist Jackson Pollock, and whose reputation suffered as a result in ways that I wanted to make clear, and also in ways that allowed me to think about the issue of her voice and how she established a voice within abstract expressionism, and what that voice was like, and what the sorts of difficulties and solutions were that she found to the problem of voice that were important to see as different, not necessarily better or worse, but different from the solutions, say, that Jackson Pollock found. And then the third example is probably less well known to many listeners, but in some ways the most rewarding, and the artist who continues to be looked at most actively today. And that's an artist called Eva Hesse, who was married to a sculptor named Tom Doyle. And this is one case where it did not seem and does not seem that the male partner outshone the female partner. Hesse was a sculptor of enormous talent who tragically died young of a brain tumor in 1970, but produced over a space of 5 years some of the most transformative and inventive works of sculpture that the 20th century saw, and who was at the forefront of what we now loosely call minimalism, and whose art has, I'm sure there are many listeners who know Hesse, partly because she's been, there was a wonderful show in San Francisco probably a good 10 years ago, but to which people flocked in droves. But through all of this.
So for those of us, Anne, that don't, just maybe a word about her then, about her, what you know of her life. And
Her life is a fascinating one. She was born in 1936, and she and her older sister, who was 2 years older, Helen Hesse, were shipped out by their German parents from their native Hamburg on a children's train to Amsterdam. And later, the parents were able to come and collect them, and they went to the U.S. They went to New York, and there, the lawyer father, as so often, took a step down in terms of his educational background and became an insurance salesman. The mother committed suicide when Hesse was only 8 years old. Hesse went on to be an incredibly talented and charismatic young woman. She went to art school at Yale in the very early 60s, and she worked with the well-known German abstractionist who taught there for many years, Joseph Albers, who himself was an immigrant from Germany and in exile in the U.S. And then once she had returned to New York as a kind of loft living. This is the beginning of loft living in New York. Her studio was on the Bowery. She set out on this extremely venturesome artistic career, which saw her using materials that had never been used in art before, including rope, and also fiberglass and latex, and creating structures and shapes that are, on the one hand, multiple and repetitive, but on the other hand, full of sort of touch and light, and strangely and quite marvelously embodied. Her works tend to hang or to sort of come down the wall onto the floor, or simply lie on the floor, and they may hang in a corner. And that new use of space is one of the things, in addition to the fragility and also tension of the work, that has made it so incredibly influential even now. I mean, there's nary a sculptor who doesn't go through a Hesse phase, it seems to me. So important was her work. So that, I mean, that does this take me too far away from the question of feminism?
No, but let's get back there then.
Somehow I've always wanted to keep feminism open as a fairly complex question, and these three artists that I've named, while women, were ferociously committed to the practice of their art and to doing it as well, you know, meeting their own standards in art. And Hesse famously said, I'm a feminist, but I'm not making feminist art. Excellence has no sex. And this is actually a very subtle thing to say, because I've come to believe with her that when we perform the multiple things that we do in our daily life, sometimes we are aware of ourselves in our gendered identities. You think to yourself, well, I, Cal, am a man and I'm doing this as a man. But sometimes you think that I'm a speaker and I'm speaking, or you go to some place in yourself where particular consciousness of, you know, your embodied selfhood, the fact that you're gendered, kind of falls away in the moment of what it is that you're doing. And I think this is a complex idea, which is conveyed very, very vividly by a phrase from Sojourner Truth, who was the African-American writer and anti-slavery agitator in the mid-19th century in America. And she, thinking about herself as a woman, asked the question, am I that name? And it's a such a suggestive thing to say, because it brings up the way that a self and a name go together. And for her, the name in question was woman, and she was writing as a woman who was conscious of her blackness and also knew that there were certain kind of definitions of identity into which she did and did not fit. And that phrase actually became the subject of a book about gender by the British poet Denise Riley, in which she raised exactly this question of, you know, of what it is like to move among the complex aspects of self which make up our sense of individuality, our, quote, modern sense of individuality, to know that there are labels and then there is you, and that you sometimes do and don't kind of match up with the definition that's out there. So that was the big question that I was trying to ask in this three artist, three women book. And when I titled it, I used the awkward solution of writing three artists and then a parenthesis, three women, and then a closed parenthesis, just to suggest that the modifier was difficult, or was a partial one, that one could be an artist and sometimes a woman, even though one always knows that you do return to yourself as man or woman in the last analysis, although even that I would be sort of prepared to debate. When, I don't know about the last analysis, really. In any event, that's sort of what I was thinking about there. But in other feminist projects, for example, this book called Mother Stone, I took up what seemed to me to be a profoundly feminist question, but no one that hadn't been seen in a feminist light.
Let me say again, let me just interrupt you, sorry, for a minute.
Yeah, please.
Readers should really have a look, I think, and we'll probably be too modest to say this, but this is really a splendid book, Mother Stone. Wonderful to read, beautiful to look at, and it takes up these themes that she's been talking about this morning. Henry Moore, for instance, the British sculptor, daughter, son of a coal miner, and the depictions that you'll see in this book, and you really should see it, of women, especially mothers and pregnant women. Is that right? Will that help our listeners?
Yeah, I think it will. It's a book that looks at this amazing phenomenon in early 20th century Britain. So, I mean, the teens, the 20s, the 30s, which saw the production of lots of imagery, of lots of sculptures of either the pregnant female body or the nursing mother and child, in a way that when I sort of realized that this was a constantly recurring theme, I couldn't understand it, because these were not, there's only one other place where you see this theme, and that is in Christian imagery. And there you see the mother and child repeatedly, as we all know. But I didn't know why it should have happened that for this 30-year period in England in particular, the most ambitious sculptors of the day went to the pregnant body and the nursing mother. And I tried to answer that question in the book, and it led me in various directions, including, I mean, one of the things that you will see is it leads into the sort of science of anatomical representation and how the womb was represented and how the womb was studied in the 19th century, how it was dissected and so on, all of which fed back into the sculptures that I was studying. There was one amazing piece which has been destroyed, of a figure called, a standing male figure called Matter. And that figure was part of a decoration on a building that was destined to be occupied by the British Medical Association, which still exists. And they wanted a kind of investigation into the story of life from its first conception through youth and active adulthood. And the sculptor who took on that commission, who was a transplanted Jewish New Yorker called Jacob Epstein, made, as part of this decoration, made this towering figure of a man named Matter holding a block of stone. And on the surface of the stone is, in shallow relief, one of the most, probably the most, anatomically correct rendering in stone of a fetus in the womb that one could encounter. It's the most astonishing migration from anatomy into sculpture of an image like that I think one could ever encounter. We know it, even though it was destroyed under dubious circumstances at best, we know it because a plaster version of it, which was the model, still exists. So the problem, to repeat, was how would a feminist look at this strange phenomenon that men and women alike were so drawn to what, on the face of it, is a deeply traditional subject, maternity, and used it kind of to bootstrap into place England's first adventurous avant-gardist sculpture. The artists in question, particularly Moore and Hepworth, made the biggest contribution in many ways to sculpture in England. And they started through this strange overlap between an idea of sculpture as a medium, sculpture as full of life, which is what they believed, and the aliveness of the maternal and infant bodies. And it ultimately goes back, I conclude, to this idea, this overdetermined idea of sculpture as able to communicate a kind of aliveness, which when you consider what sculpture is made out of, inert materials, is all the more fascinating as a ploy, as a set of beliefs. Of course, the question of how alive art is one that artists go back to and back to. What will bring it alive, and what will be the terms of its aliveness? This is the story of Pygmalion, which is, of course, the story of sculpture, but recast in early 20th century terms. And the idea that the stone itself is a mother helps us to bear in mind this kind of belief that this aliveness will be brought out of the stone. I think it's very very amazing, and I think that there certainly are other moments in human culture when making the sort of capability that humans have to make something is seen as particularly female, but they're few and far between. I mean, we can go back into language, and I mean, everyone, I suppose, has seen vinegar, when it's vinegar coming out of wine, and it comes into its sourness because there is a mother at the bottom, as this is the name we have, isn't it, for this wonderful collection of organisms that sours the wine, accumulates at the bottom of the bottle, and it's the mother that will fabricate this new substance. And I know that studies of casting processes in Africa have shown that among certain tribes, the oven in which the bronze is melted is given a symbolic shape in which the legs of a woman are actually made in clay, and the founder reaches in between the legs to get the cast object out, which is again a kind of personification or humanizing of a technical process. But it doesn't happen very often, and it certainly happened in England in this crucial 30 years between the wars, which is not accidental, I don't think.
Well, Anne, this is, I need to interrupt again. This is KZYX. Our program today is talking about California. I'm your host, Cal Winslow, and we're talking to Anne Middleton Wagner. And we've just been listening to some of her thoughts about one of her latest books, which is called Mother Stone, The Vitality of Modern British Sculpture. And that's available, as I said before, it's really a beautiful volume that's available at Yale University Press, published in 2005. Anne, I wonder if we could just move then, you know, maybe almost finally to your latest book, another handsome volume, I have to say, University of California Press published last year, entitled "A House Divided: American Art Since 1955." So, reading about it, it's about art in the United States during the past half century, but not just that. It's about this long period of American world domination, it seems. And looking at my notes, I may be confusing things here. I think this may have been what you said, that it examined the experience of hegemony from the inside, and that it involved the interface of art and nation, the aesthetic and empire, but also in ways that remind us that art shores up the nation's larger power, but also helps us imagine an alternative thing. So that's an awful lot in a book, but can we start a little bit about maybe what you mean by deep divides in U.S. society and how that happens in art?
Yes, it is a big mouthful, and I hope that listeners will have already figured out that I tend to think and write very concretely. So big divides in American culture will get played out in the book, not least given its time period, primarily through the lens of race. And that's one of the biggest divides, and one that is still with us, and one that has left an important impact on American art, although maybe one that is not often focused on sharply enough. In the case of A House Divided, for me, the issue took the form of two different essays, quite distinct in character. One was to look at a series of paintings that were made by Andy Warhol, in which he titled, and it's a significant misnomer, he titled Race Riot. They were actually of protests in Birmingham, Alabama, which were hardly riots. In fact, they were organized protests by African Americans there, which were responded to with great violence by police, who had trained police dogs as part of their armament, as well as water pumping out of fire hoses and so on. The other one is a set of fascinating works by a contemporary artist who now actually lives in Maine, Kara Walker, who is African-American, whose family lived in California, although she was educated in Atlanta. And she has an amazing way of working, and it has allowed her to go back into the myth and reality of the experience of slavery in the United States. She works in silhouettes, black and white mostly, although in more recent work, color has been added. And I wrote that essay, absolutely, talk about immediate influences. I saw a show of her work that was at CCA in Oakland, and it was one of the most amazing shows I've ever seen. A big panorama with her cutout figures of sort of refugees from Gone with the Wind, really, various figures that one is able to identify because she deals so cleverly and so actively in a common inherited language of stereotype from the 19th century, and to explode, and I mean, we might say desublimate the myth of race and the myth of slavery, so that she turns the whole thing into a erotic spectacle. So in that instance, the deep divide is around race. Another essay takes up another divide, which may be more generational if one is, you know, maybe sensitivities around this issue are more generational. But for me, the Vietnam War was one of the great divides of the nation. And still, I mean, it's only really now that the question of, you know, did a man fight? How does that play out in his public identity and his chance for holding office and so on? And I looked at this amazing monument by Maya Lin in Washington, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which remains one of the single most powerful 20th century memorials, I think, that has ever been, you know, that it has been made, and provided a solution to this question of the war. It's a solution which may not heal the divide, but certainly creates a situation where the spectator and her own relationship to the names of the dead, and the sense of her presence in a world where the 58,000 men lost their lives in the service of a war which has roundly been condemned since as the evidence of, you know, overweening American intervention in a world halfway away, in a nation half the world away. This is her solution, I think, remains really powerful, and I tried to speak to exactly where that power lies. But I also think that one of the divisions that the book wants to take up in its use of a house divided, which is, of course, a phrase from Abraham Lincoln, is the division that happens in art between an art which is politically aware and an art which is perhaps focused on the studio and investigating the nature of an art much more metaphorically. And the division that I built into the book was between art and politics, I suppose, is a shorthand way of saying it. Not that the book doesn't take a stance that says political art or art about art is the right way to go, but to try to draw out some of the implications of both, including the implications of art about art or art about the practice of art, which the other half does try to investigate. I think that one of the things that strikes me now that I live in London is how much this book is bound up with my life as a teacher. It's dedicated to my students at Cal, to all of them. There were lots of them, and these essays, more than any, come out of experiences in the classroom that I had the help and response of many, many students in writing them, and I gave them as papers, which my students heard, and I published the book, coincidentally, it has to be said, as I left the U.S. I turned in the manuscript in May and left in June. And it actually was printed when once I was established here, and it was a very for me it was a real moment of transition, and moreover that transition was one that the university seemed to be going through financially above all, but in terms of morale, in terms of the relationship between excellence and the marketplace, which has become very strained in the University of California, between speed up and scholarship, between support for students in the humanities in particular, and support for students in the sciences. And already the protests on campus had begun before I left California, and I was there and continued to watch once I had left with pain for what was going on there. Listeners will have heard you, Cal, say at the beginning that I went to a great number of East Coast schools, and one of the great choices and privileges of my life as a teacher was that I was so long associated with a great public university, and I believed completely that Berkeley was the best public university possible. And I felt over the decades so much of, you know, my life in California was marked by Californians who had been through UC and therefore had become citizens of this state, and the better for that experience, educated and committed and, you know, making California the kind of experimental and wonderful place it is. And the idea that that would be anything that could be sacrificed was unbearable, simply because you have to have gone to the other schools to see how fantastic UC was, and now from far away, I hope, still is or will be again soon.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Very interesting and moving thought, Anne. Let's just finish up then by going back, and I think I'll just do this. Thank you, you know, very much for taking the time, all this time, to talk to us. We've been talking to Anne Middleton Wagner, and I want to mention the books that we've been talking about. One is Three Artists, Three Women. That's University of California Press in 1996. The second, Mother Stone, The Vitality of Modern British Sculpture, and that's Yale University Press in 2005. And the latest book that we've just been talking about, which really has to be extremely highly recommended. Her latest book is A House Divided, American Art Since 1955. And of course, that's UC Press again, coming out just last year. So Anne, good luck to you in your work, ongoing work, I know, in London. And thanks again.
Thank you, Cal.
And we'll be back with talking about talking about California next week. Thank you all for listening, and good morning again.